The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. We're going to start, as we usually do, with an essay from the book, 80 Things to Do When You Turn 80. And again, remember, you don't have to be 80 to do these things. This one is called A Work in Progress by Reverend Margaret Stortz. She is a minister and practitioner of religious science. While working on this article, I find that I've been thinking of my life in terms of decades rather than just years. A scattering of years seems indeterminate, but counting decades sucks me right into seriously accounting for my time. Equally daunting is the awareness that I now have much more of a past than a future to consider. Time has seemed to speed up as the years begin to clump together more. Do I fear that what eventually lies ahead? I may have once, but not now. I don't spend a lot of time figuring out who I am. I've done enough of that already. What I do notice is that I have many days when I look into the mirror and ask, how in the hell did this happen? I haven't decided whether turning 80 is an accomplishment or a shock. The essays in this book involve doing things after you turn 80, but that assumes we're approaching or have approached this milestone age with a full head of steam and are already moving vigorously into advancing years. Must we delineate certain things to do now that the magic number has arrived? Maybe, and perhaps there are some glimmers of newness to be explored. Perhaps picking up a few new dance steps, or maybe more pointedly, learning to bring home more love into a caregiving circumstance. Hang gliding? Definitely not. I am not sure that marking a special birthday is so much about what we do as much as what we have learned. If we continue to make the same uninformed mistakes we made when we were younger, what is the advantage in just packing on years? Is being old and dumb more of an accomplishment than being young and dumb? Perhaps an honored birthday should be more about how to move into a boundary-blasting mindset rather than just continuing to slep along by default. Actually, turning 80 is different than it used to be. I am not my mother's 80, and I am quite sure that my daughter's 80 will not be mine. I have lived long enough now to have created a history of my own, and from it I have gained a thing called perspective. I discovered that I would not die of disappointment, although as a younger person, I often felt that death on such occasions was imminent. It wasn't. I know this much. If the people who come into our lives do not get to be themselves, we will eventually be very lonely. Others cannot possibly be who we want them to be, and they cannot possibly fill the holes in us. They were never meant to. They walk with us, and we walk with them, along the multiple paths our lives will take. We are, of course, making an assumption that we shall live to be in our 80s. A reasonable assumption, to be sure, given the many ways that are now available to us to maintain a healthy and longer life, if we choose to employ them. Nevertheless, it is wise to take some sidelong looks at what and how we are creating expectations that do alter the flow of our lives. Then, of course, we keep dreaming and steaming. When I look in the mirror at the face I did not plan on, I ask myself, am I growing old? Then I remember a TV ad that asks, doesn't growing old mean living longer? This is a really, really good question with multiple, sometimes complex answers. On the other hand, growing old is an established condition. Not much we can do about that, but growing older is a work in progress. It is open-ended, not fully established, still malleable. Given my choices, I think I'll opt for this because I certainly wouldn't want to miss something. So turning 80, nailed it. Now on to 90. Now, moving on to the Mayo Clinic's Understanding Alzheimer's, Your Guide to Brain Health, let's look at the sidebar article about other tests used to study mild cognitive impairment. Additional diagnostic tests under study in the identification of mild cognitive impairment include spinal tap procedures and molecular imaging tests, such as positron emission tomography, PET. Studies suggest that a spinal tap procedure to measure levels of specific forms of beta amyloid and tau protein in the fluid around the brain and spinal cord may be useful in making a diagnosis. These proteins, which you'll learn more about in the next chapter, help determine if someone with mild cognitive impairment is undergoing changes in the brain that could lead to dementia, including Alzheimer's disease. PET uses special tracers that stick to large protein deposits in the brain. Beta amyloid is a protein that clumps together and hardens into plaques that cause nerve cells in the brain to die. These plaques are associated with the development of Alzheimer's disease. A PET scan can help a doctor identify if someone has these plaques in the brain. The Pittsburgh compound B, capital P, little i, capital B, radio tracer is used in PET scans to indicate a buildup of beta amyloid. As the color bar indicates in a picture here, cooler colors such as blue and green show lower levels of beta amyloid, while warmer colors such as yellow and orange show higher levels. The cooler image shows a brain that's cognitively normal. It contains normal levels of beta amyloid, indicated by the blue and the green colors. So it's just blue and green, very calm. The middle image here depicts mild cognitive impairment resulting from a buildup of beta amyloid, and it begins to show a little lighter colors here and there. And the image on the right comes from someone who's been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, and you can note the areas with abnormally high levels of beta amyloid, because now we're looking at very little green, no blue, and a lot of yellow and orange. Determining a cause. Once a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment has been made, the next step is to figure out what's causing it. This often involves using imaging tests. Magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, can show if a tumor or the effects of a head injury may be producing these symptoms. An MRI may also be used to look for blood vessel damage in the brain, such as that stemming from a stroke. Imaging tests can also identify shrinkage or atrophy in the brain, signaling that mild cognitive impairment may be due to damaged brain neurons, neurodegenerative disease. Imaging tests can also highlight the hippocampus, the part of the brain important to memory. Studies suggest that people with mild cognitive impairment who progress to dementia often have a smaller hippocampus. Researchers are studying other types of imaging to help evaluate mild cognitive impairment and predict whether the impairment is likely to develop into dementia. Most likely to return to normal cognitive, For example, functioning imaging. Imaging that looks at brain activity rather than the brain's physical structure suggests that certain changes in brain activity may occur with mild cognitive impairment. These changes may serve as markers helping to identify if someone has a higher risk of progressing from mild to cognitive impairment to Alzheimer's disease. Molecular imaging tests may be another valuable tool. For example, positron emission tomography is another area of ongoing study. Currently, molecular imaging tests are used mostly for research and aren't a routine part of a neurological exam. As treatments to prevent Alzheimer's disease are discovered and they become readily available, tests to identify mild cognitive impairment will likely become more important. That is because individuals with this mild cognitive impairment at risk of progressing to Alzheimer's dementia will be the group most likely to benefit from early treatment. Now we're moving on to AARP, the magazine, a money saver article. Steering clear of hidden fees. Why advertised prices aren't what you end up paying and what you can do about that. When is a price not really the price? When there's a fee slipped in as well. Hidden fees or surcharges or bill add-ons have been around forever, but they proliferated during the pandemic, with additions ranging from $2.19 COVID surcharge on takeout sushi to new safety fee of $900 to move into an assisted living facility. It's fine for businesses to pass along to customers expenses and government fees. The problem arises when these and other costs are belatedly dropped in or hidden off to one side. You see one price for a hotel on a website, then show up and must pay $50 more per day for a resort fee. Those online flowers end up costing far more than advertised because the price that was on a display didn't include service charge. Economists call this drip pricing, since fees add up slowly like water dripping from a faucet. Why do companies employ it so often? It raises profits, says Steve Tadelis, professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley's Haas School of Business. It's as simple as that. As scholars who have studied pricing have found, and as car salesmen have known for decades, drip pricing encourages you to make a purchase. If you're presented with a low initial price first and mandatory extras later, you're more likely to buy that item than you would if you'd been presented with the total price up front. Drip pricing nudges you to make a more expensive purchase, Tadelis and his co-authors found in a recent study. And whether you're deciding to buy a car, rent a hotel room, or choose a cable TV provider, you're more likely to pick the seller with the lowest advertised price, even if a rival's total price beats your choice's ultimate cost. People anchor on the base price, and they don't pay adequate attention to the surcharges, says Vicki Morwitz, a Columbia Business School marketing professor and co-author of a recently published study of drip pricing. Interestingly, all this behavior holds true for online purchases, when comparison shopping might require only a few clicks of a mouse, as opposed to, say, a half-hour drive to another car dealership. There are several reasons for this, says Morwitz. Once consumers learn the final price, they tend to overestimate the time and effort it will take to find a better deal, and worry that they'll lose the one that they have. Airlines and ticket sellers for live events stoke that fear by using countdown clocks for completing a transaction or indicating that only two seats are left at a particular price. Also, consumers often incorrectly believe that all sellers charge similar fees, Morwitz says, and people like to feel like they've gotten a good deal, so they might decide they've landed one even if they pay much more than the price they first clicked on. Consumers don't like to feel like they've made a mistake, she says. For defending yourself against hidden prices, emotional control is crucial. Try not to get too excited about what you see as the first price on the first page, Morwitz says, and consider pushing back when you're confronted with an unexpected surcharge. Consumer Reports found that 3 out of 10 people, only 3 out of 10, complain about hidden fees. But of those who do, almost two-thirds get at least some money returned. Here are a few of the many products and services where hidden fees commonly abound. Cable television. The average U.S. household spends $217 per month on cable TV. How do bills creep up? From those $79 a month plans you see in ads? Partly, it's the premium channels you add on. But also blame monthly fees like these. A charge for broadcast TV that's free, in quotes, local channels, of up to $16.95 with Charter. Regional sports fees, generally from $7 to $12, even if you pay extra for a sports package. Set-top box rental, $12 with Verizon, Fios, and an HD technology fee, $10 at Comcast Xfinity. Your options? You could switch providers every 12 months to get lower teaser rates. If that's too much work, just call your provider annually and say you are considering switching to a different provider or quitting cable entirely. You'll often get a cheaper rate. In fact, cutting the cord to rely entirely on streaming services for TV is increasingly popular. But be on notice. Once you start subscribing to several streaming services, the costs can add up again. Cell phones. Fees can sneak up on you here through data usage. You might be paying a lot for a large monthly data allowance with all you can surf plan you don't really need. Or you might pay less for a smaller data plan and get hit by a surprise $300 charge that arrives after your 9-year-old grandson secretly watches hours of videos on your smartphone. Your options? Sign up for alerts that warn you if you're near your monthly data limit. Go online via a secure Wi-Fi connection when available, rather than your cellular network. Internet service. Check your bill for a network access and maintenance fee. RCN, for example, charges $5.57 per month. You may also be paying for hardware. Comcast Xfinity charges $168 a year for renting a modem. Your option? Buy your own modem for $50 to $130 and ditch the monthly rental fee. But make sure it's really removed from your bill. Until December 2020, Internet service providers could legally assess that monthly fee even after customers bought their own equipment. Travel. At the rental car counter, you're asked to pick a series of options while people behind you impatiently grumble, gas, tolls, collision damage waiver, and more. Cities love taxing visitors, so you'll also pay a fee if you rent a car at the airport. Maybe even if you rent nowhere near it. By the time you reach your hotel, you'll be in no mood to debate the charges, such as that mandatory resort fee. Your options? Go on the car rental firm's website before you travel to decide what options you will or won't need. At the hotel, be annoying. Relentlessly ask for the total cost at every turn. And if the pool or gym is closed, ask for a resort fee refund. Investing. One in four people with investment accounts don't know if they are paying any fees, according to a 2019 survey. 37% of people with a 401k told TD Ameritrade they didn't think they paid any fees at all. That's a sign that the investment industry, deliberately or not, does a poor job of explaining its fees. Your options? If you are working with an investment professional, have her explain in detail how and how much she's being paid on your account. In addition to any fees you are charged, that may mean a 7% commission on your variable annuity or an annual payment from the mutual fund company operating your funds. And for those where those charges hide, this is a little sidebar article. Five clicks away, websites show a product's price up front, but reveal extra fees only after you've entered shipping info. in fine print, a collection of small and vaguely named surcharges at the bottom of a bill can really add up. And finally, amid the rush, it's harder to catch and question fees when you're checking in, checking out, or at the rental counter. Now we have another money-saving article. Fending off a dubious debt, a woman's credit card forgotten for 2 decades comes back to haunt her. The problem. I had an almost perfect credit score, Nancy Hormacho, 74, wrote me. But last fall, her score had dropped more than 150 points to below average. The immigration attorney soon uncovered the problem. A credit card she had held jointly with her former husband. They separated in 2001 and divorced in 2007, yet never closed the account, which she forgot about. By last year, though, he had charged $20,000 on the card and stopped paying. A collection agency came after Hormachi, putting the debt on her report from the Experience Credit Reporting Agency. What can I do to restore my credit? She asked. The advice. Joint credit cards, the type she had with her ex, making each responsible for the debt, are a rarity. Most cards with multiple users now have a single holder responsible for the debt and authorized users who don't have to pay the bill. Even so, debts will show up on your credit report whether you're a joint account holder or just an authorized user, said Sally Taylor, vice president of scores at FICO. Your credit card feeds into scores such as FICO's, which companies use to decide, among other things, how much interest to charge on loans. So when you end a marriage, it's important to verify that all your accounts are consistent with your divorce decree, which should stipulate responsibility for debts, said Rod Griffin, Senior Director of Public Education at Experian. That may mean refinancing a jointly held mortgage and dropping an authorized user from credit cards. Divorce decrees also sometimes have a hold harmless clause in which a spouse agrees that you're not liable for a debt even if it was originally in your name. Hormachia could use that to get her ex-spouse to pay the $20,000 she is now liable for, says credit expert John Alzheimer, who often testifies in these cases. But this was easily avoidable, he says, blaming a bad divorce attorney for not identifying joint liability and not doing something about it when they got divorced. So what should she do to fix the problem now? Go on the offensive, says the experts. 1, pull all credit reports. Look for the offending debt and other debts too. The 3 major credit bureaus, Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion, are providing free reports weekly through next April at annualcreditreport.com. 2, contact the lender. She should explain her situation and see if the lender will take her name off the account, says Alzheimer. If so, she should get confirmation in writing. 3, talk to the debt collector. If the debt has gone to a collection agency, she should contact it with a similar request. Success is not assured, warns Alzheimer. They are going to want thousands of dollars. 4, review your divorce decree. Consult a lawyer and consider pursuing legal remedies against your ex. The outcome. Even before emailing me, she got on the case. She contacted the bank that had issued the card. She filed a dispute with Experian, claiming she had no control of it. She took legal action, still pending, asking her husband for money to pay off the card. But when I had her pull all her credit reports, we got a surprise. The debt was gone, and her score was back, up in the 800s. Either the bank or the collection agency had backed off in response to the dispute initiated by the consumer, stated Experian. Though she likely solved her problem herself, she's glad she called attention to this post-marital debt problem. It's just a hole in the system that they can still come after you if you don't plug it up. Now we'll start a new series, The Barrier Breakers. African-American sports figures talk about the heroes who paved their way. Jackie Robinson, 1919 to 1972, the first black man to play in Major League Baseball in the modern era, starting at first base for the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947. Blacks had been told for so long that we couldn't play Major League Baseball with white players. For black athletes and black fans, it was a sign of hope and opportunity when Jackie made it there. Most blacks who were baseball fans then were fans just because of him. We didn't want anyone giving us anything. Just give us a chance. So I grew up idolizing Jackie, even though I didn't understand his passiveness. But as I got older, I came to realize that my father had internally absorbed certain negative things in order to succeed, and he taught me that. And that's what Jackie did. He channeled whatever inequalities and anger he felt into excellence on the field. And this was by Dusty Baker, 71, manager of the Houston Astros. He played 19 seasons in Major League Baseball and was a three-time Manager of the Year in the National League. Pelé, 1940, soccer's first black global superstar, helping Brazil win the 58 World Cup. I was influenced by Pelé through the movie Victory. I couldn't have been more than 12. He was playing himself, and it was so amazing. I didn't understand that I was watching one of the greatest footballers ever. We didn't have a lot of high-profile soccer players in the U.S., but he inspired so many African-American kids to play. He looked just like us. I think people underestimate the power of that. That's from Brianna Scurry, 49, who was the starting goalkeeper for the U.S. Women's World Cup Championship soccer team in 1999 and is a two-time Olympic gold medalist. Wilma Rudolph, 1940 to 1994, the first American woman to win three Olympic gold medals in 1960 in track and field. Wilma inspired a nation and inspired me to do something I didn't know was possible or achievable. Not only was she black, but she had had polio. She went from not being able to walk to performing in front of the world. She also became my mentor and a friend. When we would discuss her battle against racism, she would always tell me, "Never be bitter. Rise above." That's what I saw in her, even though she was denied eating at a counter because of the color of her skin. And that was from Jackie Joyner Kersee. Well, folks, we're run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.